Due to the graphic nature of some of the content in this episode, listener discretion is advised. June 9th of this year marked the 10-year anniversary of Matt Stewart's murder. Back in Mooresville, the milestone was commemorated with a cold and familiar silence, with no statement from the police department or reminder in the local press. A bizarre and hideous crime again went unmentioned as it rounded the corner on a decade. They say patience is a virtue, and undoubtedly it is, but like trust or tolerance, patience can be misplaced, particularly in the face of injustice. Justice is also a virtue, and while not intrinsically opposed to a thoughtful and measured patience, the two often find themselves at odds. Whether circumstantial or systemic, injustice is often perpetuated by delay, bolstered by a patient complacency, hurled into the cruel passage of time. My name is Freddie, and this is Unforgotten, a podcast series pining for explanations, scaling the rungs of a fabled investigation into the unsolved murder of Matt Stewart.
Back in June, a husband and a wife were asleep in their upstairs bedroom here when a stranger came in, brutally attacked, and killed the husband.
It was personal.
Why isn't he dead? In the bed.
She had the baby in the bed with her. The gunman's in the doorway.
Somebody had snuck into the house and had hid out somewhere.
You won't find this in the papers, but I swear to God it's true.
Nobody knew where she was.
The mattress was covered in blood.
It was August of 2009 when then-Governor Bev Perdue issued a proclamation offering a reward upwards of $5,000 for any information leading to the arrest of Matt Stewart's killer or killers. Her office also allocated funds for the distribution of 500 flyers in Iredell County to raise public awareness and further press the need to identify the perpetrator. Despite those efforts, it wasn't long at all before this whole situation began to lose what little attention it had. By the following summer, the subject of Matt's murder all but vanished from the public sphere, relegated to rumors and speculation on back-alley internet message boards. And when I first began pursuing this case, I spent a lot of time combing through years of posts on these online forums. Much of the threads were just people reiterating what had been reported on in the press and providing links to articles which have long since been deleted. But there was a post that quickly caught my attention. It was published from an anonymous user in March of 2012 on a site called Dream and Demon. It reads in part, quote, "The wife's mother told police she'd had a dream or either woke up and saw two men in her bedroom. So she got up and went to her daughter's house, but had the presence of mind to stop by a store and bought a gallon of milk. She used her key to go in the house and put the milk in the refrigerator. She said this was common. It was around 11 p.m. Typically, she claimed, she would sleep on their couch. However, this night, she took a blanket off the couch and went and got back in her car, apparently leaving the front door unlocked. She sees or hears nothing." End quote. This mysterious post goes on to openly speculate as to how the Stewart's 3-year-old daughter was able to sleep through the gunshots. And in the same post, the author later asserts that the, quote, "wife's grandmother owns, or did own, one of the biggest insurance agencies in Mooresville," end quote. Needless to say, the provocative, unverified claims in this post piqued my interest and skepticism. Initial efforts to identify its author were unsuccessful, but as I dug through public records, I was able to discredit this notion that Matt's wife or her family are somehow connected to an insurance agency in Mooresville. Angel's maiden name does match that of a former, well-known insurance agency in town. However, upon careful examination, No one in her family seems to be connected at all. If there's any relation, it's distant and likely inconsequential. However, the remembered testimony of family, neighbors, and law enforcement have suggested that other claims in this 2012 post are hauntingly accurate, like the 3-year-old daughter having apparently slept through the gunshots and the mother-in-law being at the scene due to a bad dream or feeling. Neither of these details had ever been widely reported, yet they were listed in the post. Other sections of the 2012 post remain unverified, namely this eerie part about the mother-in-law, Brenda, having traveled to the Stewart's house earlier in the night, that she went to get milk, left the front door unlocked, or was sleeping in her car. It wasn't until last summer when I finally talked to someone who told a similar story. We'll call this person Postmark.
These people are satisfied in their mind what's happened, and anybody who says anything about it's just trying to stir up trouble. Matt's father, they were going to our church, the Warrensville Church of God. This particular story that we're talking about, it went through the church. I mean, just because everybody knew him. And it was just like people were walking around in unbelief.
Postmark claims to have held a position in the Mooresville Church of God, where Matt's parents are longtime members.
I mean, it was like the day it happened, I was having conversations with people about it. And I can tell you what I was told. It's a retired pastor. He was pastor at the Mount Mourne Church of God. One of the policemen that investigated that crime scene told him directly. He was so upset and probably in confidence, and he ran his mouth. I don't think he told a lot of people, but they definitely told me. The night it happened, they got a call around midnight that she had been shot, and there was a home invasion. The story that we were told, they came in when they saw the crime scene. Matt's father, they were over there standing as close as they would let them stand. There were two children in that house. She had the baby into bed with her. The gunman's in the doorway. Matt jumps up, supposedly to protect them. She grabs the baby and runs, but leaves the sleeping child across the hall from their bedroom in the bed. She stayed at his mother's house.
Postmark is talking about Jean, Matt's maternal grandmother. It was at Jean's house where the family all gathered in the aftermath of Matt's murder.
Jean Dyson and her sister, they said, we ain't believed that for the first minute. But I don't believe a word of it, is what she said.
Everyone's talked to me about how Brenda was acting after the whole thing and how she wouldn't shut up about her story of waking up in the middle of the night.
Her story about waking up and seeing two men in her bedroom has still not been made public. But see, it keeps going back to the same thing. Okay, she wakes up, there's two men in the doorway.
Now, who did you hear that from that Brenda said?
The policeman who took her story.
The policeman who took her story directly?
That she talked to. He was the first one.
Can you tell me what his name is?
I have no idea. It might be that one you're talking to.
Yeah.
He wasn't the only one, but he is the one that told the Church of God preacher. She said, Angel's mother, she says she wakes up at her house and there's two men standing in her bedroom doorway. Then when she looked back, they were gone. So she said, well, it scared me. And then she said, as she often did, it was a habitual thing. She knew that Angel had told her she was out of milk. So Brenda gets up and she drives to Angel and Matt's house.
After the two men broke into her house?
At her house.
Well, then why would you leave the house and not call 911?
She wasn't sure if they were real or a hallucination. And so there was a good bit of question about that. Well, how would you not know? So anyway, she leaves. She stops by a convenience store, gets the milk, gets back in her car, drives to their house. She takes her keys, goes in the front door, not the sliding glass door. She goes in the front door of the house, puts the milk in the refrigerator. Then for reasons unknown, she gets up, goes out the front door, and gets back in her 4Runner and falls asleep.
In her car.
In her car.
She was supposedly in the car during the time that the murder happened?
Oh, yeah. She never got out of her car. And there was a car parked there, and she was parked behind them and then a car beside of it.
What we do know from an aerial shot of the crime scene taken later that day, courtesy of WBTV, is that there were three vehicles parked in the Stewart's driveway inside the yellow tape. Whether or not one of these SUVs belongs to Matt's mother-in-law and how and when it got there all remain a mystery.
If it was a home invasion, they didn't take anything. These people, these vicious, killing, murdering house invaders in a subdivision of about 400 houses, they go to the one house where the front door is unlocked. So they go in, they do the deed, they do the murder. Angel is shot. She goes out across the street to the neighbor and said, "Oh my God, I have been shot," and falls out on the floor with the baby still in her arms. I think those people that she went to never bought it either. I think most of the neighborhood never bought it. The Saturday after that happened, she came with Matt's parents to a function at our church. She had a Band-Aid on her wrist. By the time the police got there, needless to say, when they went in the house and saw that horrible mess they had made of that boy, it didn't take long for it to heat up. They did follow protocols.
I mean, if they followed protocol, they didn't enter the house for 100 minutes.
Well, they did go in and look at it because the cop that told it was one of the ones that went in and seen it. And somebody got that baby and took it across the street. I mean, she was two or three.
I know they went in. I'm saying that what it says on the call log is that it was 100 minutes that passed. And the reason was that they called the SWAT team, supposedly because they thought it was a hostage situation with the little girl. And I want to see if this is something that has come up with the police officer telling you this.
Lisa, well, he didn't tell me. Let me say, I do not think the people who told me what happened, they would not have made this up. They had no need. The first detective there is the one who told.
Your pastor?
No, he was Mount Warren Church God pastor. He's long since retired.
What happens if I call?
Wouldn't talk to you.
He wouldn't talk to me?
All of that was told in the strictest of confidence. He wouldn't talk to you. He would not talk to you. He told that to more than just my pastor. There were several other pastors.
So who was your pastor?
And I can promise you, he won't talk to you.
If this guy that was told all this in confidence is blabbing it to other people, then
that pastor staff, they have districts. And our pastor was the district pastor. Well, first of all, they shouldn't have been telling it anyway if it was told to them in confidence. To me, whoever did it was somebody that was young and immature. The thing about that is, Somebody young and immature could not have kept that quiet all this time. Sooner or later, somebody somewhere is going to say something to somebody. All you've got to do is keep it in people's minds. As long as somebody remembers it and somebody is talking about it, it won't go away.
Shortly into our first conversation, I began to suspect that Postmark was the source behind the anonymous Dream and Demon post. But in our conversations, Postmark has denied even knowing these forums existed. I still have my suspicions, but I found it quite remarkable when Michelle, the neighbor Hannah was staying with down the street, attested to having heard something similar about the subject of the mother-in-law's dream.
She had a dream at her house that she thought someone, she's like, God woke me up and told me someone was breaking in my house. And she said it wasn't my house. So she said, I got in my car and went to my daughter's because God told me something was wrong there.
When Postmark claims that the mother-in-law's car was already parked in the driveway during the murder, it runs counter to the original narrative we've heard from multiple sources, all of whom say the mother-in-law arrived in the neighborhood shortly after police did, that she made her way around the blockade on Shepherd Hill Drive by circling around on Northland Avenue. A few months ago, a neighbor who lived on Northland Avenue at the time of Matt's murder reached out.
On the podcast, the stories you were told is like the mother-in-law drove down the road and the cops had come down the road, and I happened to be hanging molding in my bedroom that night. And it was a nice night out, so the doors were all open, and I heard a car come flying by, you know, speeding down the road, and I looked outside and didn't see anything, and that was the only car I seen all night, and it happened to be a cop car. But no lights on. As far as I understood, the mother-in-law's car was in the driveway before the cops got there. That's what I was told, and the way that the scene was roped off, it sure does look like it was. I don't know how she would have pulled in the driveway through all the tape and the SWAT team on the lawns and all that stuff. But I can tell you for a fact, she did not drive down my road, down Northland Avenue. So she didn't come in through the other side of the development.
So explain why you know that. You said you were working on the molding in your house. Did you have a direct view of
the
street?
Yeah, I was actually, I had both windows open, hanging molding up there, and I was varnishing. So I had all the curtains off the windows. Room was lit up like a candle, you know, and I got a clear view of the street. Again, so I heard the car. I heard a car come flying down the road and looked and saw it was a cop, but again, no lights were on, no nothing.
Do you remember around what time you were in that position to where you could have seen or heard a car come down?
It was going to be probably 11:30, quarter 12. It was getting late. I remember that. It was after 11.
But do you remember, like, around the time that you saw the cop car come down?
That was, again, probably around 11:30. Again, that was the only car that went down my street that night. And it was, like, a Tuesday night, I believe. During the middle of the week, I'm like, who the hell's flying down the road this time of night? And from there, I just kind of just, you know, kept peering out the window after seeing the cop and didn't see anything. You know, the cops didn't come up the street, didn't go looking through neighborhoods, backyards, nothing. We didn't see a cop for the rest of the night, so I woke up the next morning and saw them all in the corner.
Is it possible that that was one of the squad cars that came down at 12:49?
Definitely could have been. Again, it was late. I'm not sure exactly what time it was, but I remember being really late and just hearing someone flying around. And I remember seeing a squad car go down the road, but again, no lights on, nothing like that. That's why I thought it was strange. So what is the cop doing flying down this road this late at night, you know, in the middle of the week?
And you had the windows open.
Yes, windows open. It was a beautiful night out.
How far are you from Matt and Angel's house?
I would say I'm halfway up Northland Avenue, so 10 houses. Like when you pull out of my driveway, I can, you know, I got a clear view of the corner, and I saw, you know, the ambulance and all that different cop cars down there, and then took a drive down there and said, oh shit, something happened. That's what, again, when I seen the mother-in-law's SUV was inside the driveway with tape around it.
So wait. So this is that night that you saw this?
No. This is the early morning. About 6 o'clock in the morning.
You saw her SUV. And how do you know it was her SUV?
Just being familiar with the neighbors in the neighborhood.
Had you seen that SUV at that house before?
Yes.
Did you know them at all?
Just just more friendly gesture kind of deals, small talk, things like that. Friends with a lot of the neighbors. Still am friends with people where the 911 call was made.
The Lawsons?
Yep. You know, after more and more details came out. Talking with the neighbor who's made the 911 call, the calmness in her voice and stuff like that while she made the phone call was, he said, was kind of eerie.
This is the guy that let her in?
Yeah.
And he told you that she was calm while she was...
Yeah.
And that Angel was calm during the ordeal where she went over, knocked on the door,
yep,
and called 911, that she was calm.
Yeah, unsettlingly calm.
I appreciated the Northland neighbor coming forward with his account. Personally, I don't doubt that he saw that patrol car flying down the street and that it caused him to keep an eye on Northland Avenue. He's adamant that no other cars came down the street shortly thereafter. But to me, that doesn't mean the mother-in-law's car couldn't have quietly passed by without him noticing. Postmark isn't the only person who has come forward who claims proximity to the victim's family and supposed knowledge of the investigation. I've spoken at length with an individual who was close with Angel and her family at the time of Matt's murder. For purposes of the podcast, we'll call this person Lucy.
I actually found out about your podcast through a friend. She knew that I was close to Angel, and she said, you might want to check this out. So I have been debating on whether or not to do this simply because I don't want anybody upset with me and that family, but at the same time, there's a lot of things that I don't know if you know that just seem like big things to me. It is a non-discussed topic with that family.
So how long have you known them?
I think I originally met her in the summer of 97, like at the end of summer, right before Angel got pregnant with Hannah. We met at a church. So I was around the whole time she was pregnant. I was 16 years old. She was more like a big sister to me. We kind of immediately were drawn to each other. Hannah was my baby doll. Like, I babysat all the time. I was constantly up, because at the time she lived with Brenda, and at the time her oldest brother lived next door. Her brother Scotty had a house right next door. Angel was very lost when she ended up pregnant. And so I really feel like when she got pregnant, she felt the draw to change her life, if that makes sense. You know, she wanted that stability. She wanted it for Hannah. I mean, when she met Matt, like, everything changed, and it was, like, the greatest thing ever. And I think I remember, like, the first time I met him, she had him over, or I got there, and then he was coming. So she was, like, telling me, like, all about, you know, I've been hearing about this Matt guy. And so she finally, like, I think I was there. I think I was going to watch Hannah. And he came over, but, like, he hung out with us, and I was still super young. You know, Matt and I kind of had our own relationship. We had a very fun relationship. Matt was murdered. I didn't hear about it until, that morning, like, or that afternoon, like, on the news. Like, it's a 5 o'clock news. Is when I got, like, I literally saw it on the news, and I, like, freaked out. My kids are out of town. So I literally got in my car, drove to the church. Like, the news said there was a candlelight vigil at the church. So my gut instinct was to go to that church because I knew. Because at that point, I wasn't going to start calling Angel. Like, I just felt weird about making that phone call. So I got in my car and drove to Riverlight, and I ran into Scotty, and he grabbed me and he hugged me, and we kind of like walked away by ourselves, and he told me where Angel was, which was at Matt's grandparents' house. And he told me how to get there. He was like, go there. So by like 6:30 or so, I was at Matt's grandparents'.
You went to Jean's house.
Yes, I did. And I knew them. Like, I met Matt's family. I mean, I had gone to birthday parties and the babies were born and wedding. It just, I knew Matt's family. I just never in my life, like never in my wildest dreams. I mean, I knew he had a past. And
what
I
did you know, like, about the past?
I didn't know much. He, like others have said, he wasn't, you know, he didn't really share much. I mean, he would tell me like, yeah, like my past is, you know, broken. I didn't understand. I remember going straight to the house, getting to the house, and it was just like, it was very sad. There was a lot of people there too, and I kind of stayed back a little bit in the beginning. Like, I didn't want to like go barging in. But once Angel saw that I was there, she came to me and like hugged me and held on to me and just like started sobbing. it was one of those weird things where you, like, you want to be supportive, but you don't know what your role is supposed to be right there in that moment. You know what I mean? Brenda wanted to go clean the house. She made the comment that she was going to go clean the house, and I am standing there like...
Do you remember her saying that, like, immediately?
Yeah. Like, it was a talked about thing. I was like, isn't there a service for that? Like, isn't there somebody that comes in and does that? Like, why would you do that?
Yes.
Like, I didn't even want to go in that house, and it was not my, like, family. Like, I didn't want to see that bathroom. I mean, hearing about the stories were bad enough. Hearing the... You know, the handprint, blood stains on the wall, and hearing about all that was hard enough for me, much less trying to go in and be the one that scrubs it all down. Like, what? So it was almost like she wanted to wipe it all away. It was a very weird situation. And I will tell you, the week that Matt died, like planning the funeral, all that stuff, I was there. I mean, I was the one that went to Walgreens to print the photo that was put in the obituary for Matt. I did that. So when I mean like I was there, I was there. I mean, I was definitely there. Yeah, I was at the house when they were pulling family members. All of her family members were polygraphed. She was polygraphed.
You said all the family members were polygraphed, like the brothers?
Yep, the brothers, her dad, her mom. So from our standpoint in the very beginning, I never thought anything. And the reason I never even thought Brenda, she loved Matt. She was heavily involved in their relationship. I mean, she had to watch the kids a lot. They worked 12-hour days. So somebody had to stay and watch the kids. I mean, they tried to work off days, but then once they realized that they were like, we should work the same day so we have the same days off with all of our kids. And so Brenda was around a lot. I do remember the first couple of days, maybe even before the funeral, where we were kind of all sitting and she started telling the story about how, you know, she was asleep. And now, you know, and I think I still understood it then because I have kids. And if you don't have kids, you don't get it. But... I mean, I do get that feeling when my son is out. You know, I get it to a degree. Would I drive over somewhere? That's the part that gets all messy for me. And I remember
What did she say? Brenda woke up because she had the bad dream, went to the neighborhood. Police are already there. So she somehow appears in the driveway.
I had recollections of Brenda already being there.
Recollection, like, you remember hearing that she was already there.
Yeah, like, the car was in the driveway when the cops got there. Like, she was in the car. Like, she got there, the house was fine, she had that nightmare, she had the premonition, and she went back into the car and got a blanket and went to sleep.
That's what you heard?
It's from them, yes. She was in the car sleeping. You have to remember, I was there. Everything I heard from somebody within that family. Yeah, I heard that.
You heard that she was at the house already, and she went to sleep in her car?
Yes, and I don't know if you ever heard, there were shell casings found in Brenda's car. I want to say they didn't match, but they spent a lot of time on Brenda. I mean, the whole family. The police did. Like, they were very focused on somebody in that family had something to do with this.
So I can't imagine why.
Yeah. And I kept seeing in that forum that, like, people said she was driving around, which I never heard that part, but the police barricade, her breaking through all that, that resonates with me big, and I believe that's what happened. I believe she was there and she left. Like, I would love to know what time Brenda woke up, because my knowledge is there had been some sort of event that day. Brenda was there, had gone home, went to bed.
From the 100-minute gap to the $300 phone call, there's no shortage of mysteries throughout this saga. But the account of a barbecue or supposed gathering that happened at Matt's house on the night of his murder continues to haunt me like no other.
I know that there was a barbecue that day. I don't know who was all there. I know that Brenda had been there. I was supposed to go, but my kids weren't in town. I was a young mom like Angel, so it was kind of one of those, like, didn't have the kids, I just wanted some free time, and I didn't go. I don't know much about it. I don't know who all was in attendance. I don't know. I mean, I had been there recently for something similar, you know, before that. Like, I had been there not long before Matt was murdered.
Because I'm trying to figure out why they would have thought that that was relevant.
I mean, I was physically told that whoever was in the house, they believed that they were already in the house when they went to bed.
Again, you'll notice I've edited out the 3-year-old daughter's name.
There's like a few things that I feel like I don't know if you've heard yet. They have this stuff that they put on the carpet. Have you heard this story?
Nope.
The footprints were found in the dining room. The footprints were found up the stairs. The footprints were found in their room. The footprints were actually found in his room.
Jesus.
Next month, we'll hear more from Lucy and some of Matt's coworkers as we dive deeper into what happened during the initial investigation. Unforgotten is a Bold Era production, written and recorded by myself, Freddie Wilson, in the always sunny Daytona Beach, Florida. Special thanks to Lucy, Postmark, and the Northland Neighbor for their contributions to this episode. As always, this series is dedicated to the life of Matt Stewart. May his memory remain unforgotten. If you have any suggestions about topics or questions to be included in future special episodes, you can submit them on the forum located at unforgotten.freeforums.net.